Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. And joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists is Richard Danzig, the 71st Secretary of the United States Navy, who is one of the founders and a former chairman of the Center for a New American Security. He is now a senior advisor to Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Laboratory, among his many, many hats. This conversation is part of a series devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment, and is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems. Richard, it's an honor and pleasure having you on the program. Thanks for making the time for us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm impressed that you can keep track of some of my many hats.
Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Bell, Beretta USA, and Leonardo DRS also have sponsored our coverage of AUSA Now, the Association of the United States Army's annual meeting, this year conducted virtually. I want to start with China. Obviously, there is an enormous debate in the national security community about how we should be responding to China. The Trump administration makes clear that it's been standing up to China. And it's true that the administration has done many welcome things in sort of addressing some of China's tendencies, whether it's its sweeping territorial claims, technological and cyber theft, coercive practices, human rights abuses. But it's sort of lacked a cogent strategy. As many have observed, when you have an authoritarian nation, all that matters is how the leader of that nation responds. And when Donald Trump asked Xi Jinping for help in an election, whether everybody else in that administration is tough becomes problematic. This is also a competitor the likes of which America has never faced. It's got a massive population, a very vibrant and very strong economy that's underwriting military, technological, diplomatic, and even growing cultural impacts around the world, while at the same time using gray zone tactics, coercion, disinformation, bribery, to advance its agenda as it flaunts sort of these global rules-based order. I know that APL has commissioned a series of six papers. You and Laurent Lascai of Georgetown University Center for Security Emerging Technology wrote Symbiosis and Strife, where is the Sino-American relationship bound? And in the paper, you argue that this is extremely different from the Cold War for a whole variety of reasons, in part because back then the goal was to avoid war with Moscow at all costs, whereas now people are not just talking competition, confrontation, but actually fighting and winning wars. And you note that interdependencies and welcome interdependencies are now being regarded as vulnerabilities. This is sort of the biggest strategic issue perhaps the nation faces. How do we need to think about this challenge, and what's the right strategy?
Well, you're certainly right to begin with focus on China. That's the central national security issue of the moment and probably of the next decades, how we and China interact. I'd point out at square one and the essay that Laurent and I wrote that you refer to tries to articulate this. The question of our technology interactions, decoupling and the like, is essentially a second order question, a very important one, but a second order question. The first order question is, what's our relationship with China? How do we position ourselves with regard to that? And the technology kinds of considerations follow from that. The administration, I think, among its several faults in this regard, not to mention some others, is that it hasn't really tried to or successfully come to grips with the larger conceptual question of our relationship with China, and has instead moved incrementally with a series of one-on-one kind of interactions, leading to, I think, some very odd priorities. I think you can make a good argument that things like dealing with Huawei is important to the national security. I think the argument becomes very strained when your next most salient priority is TikTok, when there are a lot of other more fundamental issues, as for example, our supply of semiconductors that are used in devices from the People's Liberation Army that the PLA is using. But I think the broader strategic question is well framed by observing that on the one hand, this is, as you say, not the Soviet Union. We can't take a containment theory, in my view, because for a variety of reasons, China is out there and hugely integrated with the world. It's a vibrant, modern state with economic relationships, not to mention a population of some 1.4 billion people that just are entirely different from the Soviet Union's confinement, if you will, within a closed system. On the other hand, a strategy that many of us, including me, supported in the 1990s, just clearly isn't any longer applicable. And that strategy was integrate China into the world system, give it a stake in the world system, and give it, therefore, incentives for cooperating and participating. That strategy, I think, was the right one to pursue. We needed to try that, and I think it had fair chances for success. I think it actually has had more success than people give it credit for. I think China is constrained, for example, in its attitudes or activities with regard to Taiwan or in its militarism generally by its interaction with the world system. But it is not nearly as constrained as many of us hoped or even expected. And we need to recognize that that strategy isn't sufficient either. So the problem is, where do you situate yourself between the two poles, between the containment strategy, which clearly isn't applicable, or the it's sufficient to integrate China into the global system, which also clearly isn't any longer applicable? How do you find that middle ground? And my own view is that it doesn't admit of strategic simplicity. If you articulate, as Kennan did, the in the long telegram and the like, the containment theory or the integration theory, then everybody pretty much knows what to do. When you're in between, it's much more difficult to make decisions. But my view is the touchstone is to be very clear and forceful and resistant with respect to many aspects of Chinese behavior. And we can talk about some examples. And at the same time, to recognize that we have to have a relationship, that you can't exclude such a large and important and central country with the world's second biggest economy from the world scene. And if you're going to address issues like COVID or climate change or the world economic system, you have to do it cooperatively with China. Now, it takes two to cooperate, so you can't assure that they will be cooperative. But the trick, I think, is to be extremely straightforward in condemning and resisting some forms of behavior. And at the same time, to achieve an attitude that the relationship still must be maintained and some positive forward things ought to develop. So I can give you some examples of where I think we ought to be resisting, but I don't want to give you a monologue here.
Let me. So I want to sort of dive a little bit more deeply in that in terms of examples, right? Because there are those, right, on the one hand, it's Graham Allison's thinking of a Thucydides trap, which I think did motivate the last administration. Let's try to avoid conflict. Let's try to engage where we could. I think that those who repudiate that theory of cooperation, you know, I'm told that later in life, Brent Scowcroft's realization was, wow, this is the first country in history that has actually not democratized as it's gotten wealthier, in part by harnessing advanced technology in order to do population control, and a leader who believes that doubling or tripling down on communism and authoritarianism will drive further growth. That's not assured, given when you talk to some Chinese entrepreneurs, they maintain that actually this will backfire over the long term. But in your view, and then there is also the school of thought that this is a very 1930s, you know, we're sort of in this bathtub that results in war. Hindsight on all of these things is 2020. It's all about learning lessons and moving on. What are some lessons we've learned? And more importantly, what are the ways to actually actualize a change in behavior of such a powerful nation that increasingly feels right that the United States is actually a passe power that's merely clinging to influence and needs to sort of step aside for a bold new generation of Chinese leadership who's now integrated into some of these organizations. So how do we get this right?
Well, let me start with 3 points. One is actually, though we often say that hindsight is 20/20, it isn't. It's not clear frequently what lessons we should draw from the past, and frequently we draw lessons that are mistaken or inapplicable. A second thing is that there's this wonderful comment of Zhou Enlai's, much fabled, when Kissinger said to him, what did he think of the French Revolution? And Zhou Enlai said, it's too soon to tell. I wouldn't treat China as a given. I think it's clear that Xi Jinping has led it to a more authoritarian and closer to a more totalitarian system. And I think that's deeply objectionable and should be resisted. But there are other strands in China, the dynamism of the private sector, the space that's been left for individual choice, the fact that 350,000 or so students from China are in the United States absorbing the values and the characteristics of our system. They include Xi Jinping's daughter. Sooner or later, things will change in China as they have already historically changed. This is a country which has made extraordinary pivots from, for example, the state that they were in before the Cultural Revolution to the Cultural Revolution, away from the Cultural Revolution to the openness of Deng, and then now the Xi Jinping phase. So I wouldn't treat China as a constant or a given, and indeed, one of the things we should be doing is hugely encouraging the growth in China of alternative sources of opinion. So I want more Chinese students in America. Sure, I want to restrict their study of some subjects, but I want to encourage that relationship. I want more effort to do the equivalent of Voice of America in conveying free speech and creating channels through and around and under the Chinese Great Firewall that restricts the internet and the like. And the third thing is, I wouldn't treat the United States and its domestic policy as a given. This is a country which proceeds by zigs and zags, that falls behind, has regressive moments, and then lurches forward. So the strongest thing I think all of us feel we can do, and this I think unites many different viewpoints in the U.S., is to build our own vibrancy, invest in our STEM students, invest in our infrastructure, invest in our R&D. And we can say more about that. But for me, those are three kind of pivotal or central propositions as we think strategically.
Is there the United States since World War II, or with World War II, built the reputation of being sort of the smartest strategic power, right? I mean, we had developed the best education system, the best technology, the best industry, emulated around the world, evangelized on democracy. Whereas now there is a sense that we can't fight wars, right? We're domestically divided, that we don't do much of anything well, right? Our electoral system doesn't even work well, right? Every other country in the world just elects somebody. No, we have to have an electoral college that some say has been hijacked from its original purpose and how it's supposed to work. Increasingly quarrelsome with our allies, right? I mean, for your strategy to work, Richard, the United States has to bring the rest of the world, the rest of the law-abiding world, in a sort of an impenetrable wall so that the Chinese recognize that they actually can't violate global norms with impunity. What sort of signal does it send the rest of the world when the United States itself does not appear to have its act squared away?
I think you're entirely right to emphasize the relationship with the allies and the importance of that. I mean, if you compare China with 1.4 billion people and us with 365 million or whatever it is at the moment, and you look at the potential in China, it's not just the 1.2 billion, 1.4 billion compared to the American population. It's compared to the world as a whole. We built our technological establishment, for example, in very substantial measure on the immigration and the like. You talk about our power after World War II. It's in some measure because we collected all the scientists from the world, particularly Western Europe. They moved to the United States and created a groundwork for us to progress in that arena. So getting the whole world to operate vis-a-vis China in productive ways is, I think, fundamental, as you say. In terms of the U.S. reputation, I think there's a very strong tendency to straight line. Really, it, as I suggested earlier, is zigs and zags. The U.S. in the 1960s with John Kennedy looks one way to the world and to ourselves. In the 1970s, besieged by Vietnam, it looks very different. In the 1980s, it looks very different again, and people are extrapolating about Japan. And in the 1990s, under Clinton and the U.S. technological revolution, it looks very different. The U.S., when we elect Obama, is the shining beacon to the world of our diversity and our willingness to embrace range. And under Trump, it's the exact opposite. It's the black hole of these kinds of values. So I think these things change and change rapidly. And the world in its judgment about the U.S. Also changes and changes rapidly. The one constant is this amazing American capacity for reinvention, for experimentation, for adaptation. And we have to treasure that. And I suppose I have to add a second constant, which I've touched on, which is our ability to absorb talent from everywhere and give it opportunity, economic opportunity, opportunity in terms of educational opportunity, opportunity to experiment with radical ideas, our valuing free speech and the like. Those are the American strengths, and those persist, and the world recognizes that. The manifestations from period to period are wildly different. And we just need to recognize, in my view, we shouldn't extrapolate from any one moment to what the next moment will be like.
While it's true that the United States is a shining example in many respects, right? Immigration being so critical. You mentioned that the reason we put man on the moon is a whole bunch of German rocket scientists came to the United States after the war, just as we were able to develop an atom bomb because persecuted physicists, most of them German Jews, came to the United States and helped sort of set the predicate for success in the Manhattan Project. And obviously we had the economic might to be able to devote to all of these pursuits. The concern is increasingly that the United States is no longer that sort of example, that we do what we do because we do it, not because it makes sense anymore, that we're not quite inventing or reinventing the way that we need to societally and organizationally, and that there's a tendency for us to say that we are the best in the world, and I'm a very proud American, so I think we are the best in the world despite our flaws. Indeed, it's because we continue to work on those flaws that makes us a truly great nation. But there's this concern that we do what we do because we do it, not because it makes sense. And so that leads to a healthcare system that doesn't work, a voting system that people around the world question, military capabilities where those even involved in $750 billion a year in spending will acknowledge doesn't deliver the kind of capabilities we need. So the answer is always spend more, but somehow end up getting less. And that's in part because we tend at the same time not to be self-reflectively honest about what we're doing wrong in order to fix it. What are the mental shifts that have to happen as this competition increases, as the stakes go up? Right. I mean, a lot of Americans look at 20 years of war in Afghanistan and Iraq and rightfully ask themselves, what did we get for those, you know, for those trillions of dollars spent and those lives lost and damaged as a consequence? How do we need to be thinking about, right, to get back to that, we get bold ideas and then we execute those bold ideas?
Yeah, there are a cluster of ideas in what you just said that I think are important and, in my view, generally true. The way I would put some of it is, you know, there's the wonderful cliche, nothing succeeds like success. My version of that cliche is nothing seduces like success. Our particular challenge is what political scientists would call path dependency. We have what we have, and that has become deeply ingrained precisely because we've been successful in a variety of ways. So it's very hard for the military services, for example, to move away from the weapons of choice that helped them to prevail in both World War II and the Cold War, because they succeeded. And the professional mores and ways of thinking about that are deeply ingrained. And there are many, many other examples of that. The healthcare system that you point to is another example of it. The counter to that has to be a clear-eyed recognition that we're in a new situation. We're dealing with new technologies, a different kind of adversary, and a different set of issues, and we have to change. And I think the great challenge is which dominates. On the one hand, the tendency of all number ones, as the U.S. has been, to become too in love with themselves and too committed to the paths they have gone down in the past and not adaptive enough. Or on the other hand, the turbulence and impulse for change that I think is so unique, really, and central to the American system. I don't know which of those two will prevail, but I sure know I want to lend my weight to the extent I can to the second and not to the first. So that to me is critical to understanding where our priorities ought to lie.
What are examples in your mind of, you know, what if, as we look to this period and try to navigate it, right? What are some examples, you know, give us an example of sort of great strategy, and then give us an example of strategic failure that can sort of help as lodestars through this process?
Well, you've seen in my paper with Loran Laskai that we just put out from the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, that I'm skeptical of our ability at the moment to generate a great strategy vis-a-vis China. And the reason for that is because we're between the two poles I mentioned, between the world of flat-out adversariness with the Soviet Union and the world of let's integrate China into the world and everything will be fine. And that in between, we need to experiment with different specific choices, see what their consequences are, see how much we can rally our allies in the world to join us, and recognize that this is a two-party game. China will, by its response, encourage us down paths that are more cooperative or more competitive or more conflicted. And we can't really prejudge that. I earlier said that our visions in 1990s about China turned out to be not right in 2020. And I suggested that our visions about China in 2020 will not, in fact, be very good predictors of 2030. China changes and changes dramatically. So we need to be careful about the strategic, the kind of call for grand strategy. Having said that, I think, though, you do need to be guided by some basic principles. And the two that I've articulated seem to me to be pretty evident. One is you need to stand up strongly, even to the point where it's creating a lot of conflict in the relationship, against things that China is doing. For example, efforts to control the South China Sea. We're entirely right to emphasize freedom of navigation, to send our ships through there and to refuse to conform to Chinese desires in that regard. Taiwan, I think, at least privately, we ought to be sending very strong signals about our commitment to defending Taiwan and not let it become the kind of thing where the Chinese think that they have a free or low-cost opportunity to take military action against Taiwan. I would be vibrant with respect to the Uyghurs and their repression. What's going on there is really the genocide of a culture. I would be vibrant with respect to Hong Kong and our objection to what's happening there. And on the other hand, as I've suggested, there's the second proposition, which is you have to be collaborative in other arenas. And I think actually the Chinese historically have been better at accepting a conflicted concept than we normally are. Ever since Descartes, it's been sort of fundamental in Western thought that you have contradictions logically and you have to choose between two positions. Chinese are more accustomed to a general mode of thought that says, I can do contradictory things. Contradiction is in the nature of humankind. To quote a very non-Chinese authority, F. Scott Fitzgerald, he wrote once that the essence of the mature mind is that we can accept two conflicting ideas at once. And I think we have to do that with respect to China.
As you look through history, so you don't see as much of a sense of here's a, you know, an example of strategic success, here's an advantage of example of strategic failure that can guide us, is just sort of more of a principled approach.
Well, I think this present circumstance calls for more of a principled approach, but there are certainly examples of strategic success and strategic clarity. What's striking is the degree to which we, though retrospectively, project them eternally back through history, rather than recognize that many of them grew incrementally. If you take, for example, the reaction to Hitler in the United States, put aside the world as a whole, it took FDR a fair amount of time, or as, for example, in World War I, it took Woodrow Wilson a fair amount of time to arrive at a clear strategy, a notion of how to rally the American public and how to create alliances abroad in ways that that then created a grand strategy that obviously was fundamental to the future of the world and obviously succeeded when we defeated Hitler. But in 1935, that was by no means so evident, nor could it have been achieved. And part of your strategic view in 1935 would have been, what is more repulsive than the Stalinist regime in Russia? And if you, in 1935, you said, our grand strategy is to form an alliance with Russia, the general reaction would be, we can't ally with the Soviet Union. Look at how repugnant they are. So some things lie in the womb of time, and you want to nourish that that entity, that unborn child, and bring it to fruition. But you have to recognize that you also, premature births frequently are stillborn births. We're not ready yet, in my view, for a grand strategy with regard to China. We are ready for recognizing the principles I've just urged.
Is there a strategic failure that you would note we should bear in mind? Because in great state affairs, it's all about calculation, but also often about miscalculation, right? I mean, the image we transmit, for example, to the Chinese reinforces their sense of us as an incompetent, sort of failing, passé state, right? And that in turn could lead to strategic miscalculation on their part.
Oh, yeah. I think there are many strategic failures. I mean, historically, for example, the U.S. buying into the domino theory that led to or mired in the war, in the Vietnam War, is a dramatic and evident strategic failure. Our conception of the world was very ill-advised. We didn't see how fragmented communism was and the like. Striking illustration, though, of our ability as a nation to change, and revitalized in part by our younger people, I'd like to proudly say, of which group I was one in the 1960s and early 70s, and which group, unfortunately, as your very nice introduction suggests, I'm no longer a member of, but trying to keep thinking and rethinking about strategic failure is, I think, really important. In terms of the particulars of our relations with China, and the present mode, I think there are what could be called strategic failures. And one of them has been the casualness with which we developed dependency on cyber without thinking through the security implications of those systems. And some of us got to that issue sooner than others, but all of us got to it later than we should have.
Let me Well, let me ask, how much bandwidth should we be devoting to Russia? Is Russia merely a regional irritant, right? Because, I mean, there are some who would put Russia somewhat more central, but it is a hybrid power. It's a military power. How should we be thinking, and how much bandwidth do we need to devote? Or is China a more easily dealt with problem than China?
I think Russia is a serious problem. You need to be concerned about it. It would be rather odd if people who were jumping up and down about North Korea, quite rightly, because it represents a real danger, nonchalantly accepted Russia, which is vastly more powerful and vastly more relevant and more globally ambitious. To say that it needs to be attended to is not to say that it's at the level of centrality of China. Russia represents, I think, as do several other nations, Iran and North Korea, real risks that cannot be ignored, but they're not as central as China. It's a little as though we were talking about COVID and your risks of dying from flu. The COVID risks are vastly higher. But if you didn't get your flu shot, you're probably making a mistake, not only with respect to COVID, but with respect to flu itself. And maybe, I don't want to over-exaggerate this, but Russia is to China as COVID, as flu is to COVID, not as central a concern, but definitely a significant one.
I want to go to COVID for a second, but you mentioned something interesting. And
teach me to use metaphors.
it was a very good metaphor that will stick in the mind, mine, and I'm sure others. How do we need to think about conflict and deterrence in a world where great powers, right? I mean, Russia is a first order military power. It's certainly been modernizing its armed forces. China is very much the same, and yet both are adopting increasingly gray zone tactics. Russia, with remarkable impunity, assassinates leaders everywhere, right? Not just Navalny at home, but whether the Skripals or, you know, I mean, there are dozens of unsolved cases around the world that now folks are increasingly concluding were the long arm of the GRU and its special office. A lot of these nations are coercing, they're bribing, in order to get political outcomes, right? I mean, one of France's major political parties was supported by Vladimir Putin, which just happens to be a nationalist party, right? I mean, something Stalin wouldn't have done. Stalin would have been much more ideologically pure to have helped the communist, and that was a hallmark of the Soviet Union. Vladimir Putin doesn't care whether it's an ultra-right or ultra-left as long as it's disruptive. Are we thinking about security? We have a tendency of thinking about it from the context of hypersonics, and are we thinking or adapting appropriately to what is a changing environment, and that the perpetrators, whether they're China or Russia, don't seem to be incurring a tremendous cost? We're focused on the military part of it, but somewhat less on actually sanctioning the Chinese for what they're doing to the Uyghurs any more than we're actually punishing Russia for its state-sponsored assassinations, for example.
Yeah, I think you're on to an important point. I tie it back to my earlier observations about nothing seduces like success and our established patterns of behavior. The French have a concept, la déformation professionnelle, the notion that there's a professional distortion or deformation that occurs when we look at things through the eyes of our training and our patterns. So every sophisticated professional tends to want to focus on the area that he or she has been well trained for and invested in, and that represents the epitome of their professional skill. The tendency is to ignore or slide or try and brush aside as other people's problems anything that doesn't fit in that basket. So if I'm a doctor, the epitome of my concept may be surgery, and what happens in the hospital. And I give way less attention to public health and clean water and ways of preventing disease by getting laymen to act differently. And if I'm a policeman, maybe I think more about arrests and gunfire, even though over the course of my career, I may only use my firearm once or never. And I ignore or want to slight things like how to handle domestic disputes, because that's not really being a policeman. It's not my business. It's somebody else's. And similarly, I think for the military, the tendency is to think in the United States of high-end, sophisticated conflict, aerial combat and the like, and give me these one-on-one, messy, ambiguous, as you say, sort of little gray men type, little green men type activities. That's not my business. That's not what I do. Give me clean warfare. And for that matter, attacks on my logistics system, the power grid or my resupply, I shouldn't have to deal with that. It's kind of not fair. It's as though I had a medieval attitude of chivalry and we're going to joust with swords and lances. And now suddenly you're throwing rocks at me. Hey, that's not real warfare. I don't train for that. I don't do that. But as your comment suggests, we need to deal with it wherever it is. And dealing with these kinds of problems is as important as dealing with public health should be for doctors. So I seem to be rich in health analogies today for reasons I think we can all guess at. But I think that we have to expand our mindset and our investments to deal with issues wherever they may arise. The cybersecurity is another example of the same phenomenon, just as I mentioned earlier. We underinvested in that. In part, it's because it didn't fit our professional image. So I think this is an important area for substantial investment and changing of our professional mindset.
Let's first talk about COVID, because you used that terrific COVID analogy earlier. But it is no laughing matter. You're not an epidemiologist. I should say that right up front, but you are an expert on biological warfare and have studied COVID, I think, more than the average person would probably recognize. This is a disease that's killed 223,000 Americans. It will do so for very, very more months. I find it fascinating that if any adversary in the world had been killing hundreds or thousands of Americans daily, we would have been at war with them in March, much less sort of being where we are right now. And it seems as though many nations made a kind of a false trade-off. Instead of locking down hard and fast and trying to separate people, we seem to want to do this selectively in certain places where it was bad and folks were still moving around. And so actually got none of the benefit. You know what I mean? We didn't avoid the economic shock. It's prolonged, while at the same time also losing large numbers of people. What should we be learning from this episode, Richard, that not only, so A, it's how to respond to this disease, but the second question is, what have we learned in the course of this disease that will prepare us better for not just a future pandemic, but actually any future national crisis, right? On one hand, we're better at distributed operations, but I'm sort of interested in that, the dual poles of that. How should we be fighting this? And what should we be learning from this that makes us better when this happens again, as it surely will?
Well, I like the way you phrased that question. Let me take it at three levels. The first is, just our ability to learn with respect to COVID. What I'm struck by is the difference between the way we gather intelligence, assimilate data, and come to conclusions in this arena, COVID, as compared with what we would do if it were actually a national security problem of the traditional kind, if we had an opponent who was waging war against us. Essentially, what's happened is that over the decades, we have built an intelligence system with a multitude of agencies, 19 or so, means of coordinating them, a system which generates clarity about consensus and dissent amongst them, and a general reckoning by national security leaders, which makes us reasonably skilled at using that intelligence. we don't defer to it too much. We recognize that it's an error if we just think whatever they tell us is true, as, for example, biological weapons in Iraq. And on the other hand, it would be extremely foolish to ignore it or not delve into it, the national security intelligence. On the COVID side, we don't have anything like that degree of integration of different efforts and information systems and development of good consensus product. Instead, we have literally thousands of scientists each pursuing whichever topic happens to fit their skill set or their interests or their available funding. And fundamental questions are not really addressed. I'll give you an example I've been beating on since March in my own efforts with respect to COVID, which is the most fundamental question, in my view, that you rarely see discussed and is not being systematically pursued, which is what a scientist would call the inoculum associated with COVID. How much of the virus do you have to inhale in order to be stricken with the disease? And obviously this varies from individual to individual, but what is for the median case, what was required to infect the typical person? In fact, I think that the amount of virus that you have to inhale is not as many people would think. Oh, if I inhale a little bit of it, it multiplies within me and I die, or I at least get sick. The reality is that a great deal of it, in my opinion, needs to be inhaled. Otherwise, we'd all be extraordinarily sick. Any interaction with anybody where there was a little bit of virus present would fail you. But there isn't a central research system that is driving adequate attention to that. And then we get things like the ad hoc COVID task force. The failings of our president in this regard are, I think, extremely evident. But quite apart from that, it's a failing of the system as well. We haven't developed a good mechanism for thinking about the central questions, orchestrating data, processing it, sharing it, et cetera. Then second, you asked particularly about COVID itself and what we should have done. I wouldn't discourage a sort of binary mentality. The word lockdown implies something which is binary. But the reality is when we so-called lockdown, we had about 40% of our workers typically going to work and maintaining so-called essential services. The buses and the subways ran. The agricultural system remained intact largely, et cetera, et cetera. The healthcare system, obviously. The real question is, how do you adjust, calibrate your system in the face of infection? That requires good data and good understanding. But I think the understanding that is emerging, and in my opinion, could have emerged much faster, is that certain forms of behavior should be restricted, as, for example, going to the bars and mass outdoor gatherings, et cetera. Certain forms of behavior should be encouraged, as, for example, distancing and masks. And you want to encourage or discourage those in varying degrees, depending on the urgency and the spread of community infection. So I would not go to the extreme, for example, of saying people ought to wear masks all the time everywhere. I don't think by and large they're required in many outdoor settings. And on the other hand, I would encourage masking indoors, and I would not move to total lockdown because that's a myth. The question is, how far do you move? And I would do things like prohibit gatherings in bars and the like. And finally, I would just suggest, I very much applaud your reference, which is more subtle than most people grasp, to preparing not just for the next pandemic, but as you rightly put it, towards the concern about risks in general. You know, people say, well, we didn't do a good job of, we keep fighting the last war. We didn't do a good job of foreseeing this pandemic. And now what we ought to do is prepare against all pandemics in the future. And my view is, hey, that's fighting the last war. If we had all been victimized by the predicted earthquake in California, everybody would be running around saying, we ought to be predicting earthquakes better, and how do we handle that? And the reality is we need systems that are sensitive to the whole range of risks and resilient and flexible enough that they give us a managerial capability against risks that we don't anticipate or that we couldn't have selected out from amongst the 500 things that we ought to be concerned about: nuclear accidents, earthquakes, hurricanes, pandemics, et cetera, et cetera, warfare. So these are this is how I would approach the cluster of points you described.
One of the things you mentioned was of systemic organization, right? So the Chinese system is authoritarian, yet remarkably laissez-faire. And so you're harnessing technology on the one hand, but you're shaping it, which is one of the reasons why China is able to do some remarkably big things in remarkably short periods of time. We tend to talk about priorities in the abstract. China talks about mastering AI. There is a definite national plan that plugs into that. In our case, we talk about AI, for example, and there, you know, and everybody's working on AI, as a little bit as you mentioned in terms of the virus, without really all that much coordination or particular oversight. But part of that could be an administration to administration difference. How do we need to think about the nexus, Richard, of all of these extraordinary technologies that are coming together with a remarkable simultaneity? You've got the communications revolution in 5G that's happening. You have a materials revolution. You have a nano revolution. You have a biological revolution. You've got artificial intelligence, autonomy. We're on the verge of a quantum age, which is going to be, I think, the most game-changing and one, you know, in as much as we have sort of a nascent national AI approach, we have no national quantum approach. And as we've seen, our Chinese friends are already starting to demonstrate, you know, obviously there's a big leap we've got to make from the demonstration of quantum keys that they just demonstrated, but still indicates we're about a decade away. And anybody who's got quantum is sort of an alien coming up against cavemen without it. How do we, well, I mean, it's true, right? I mean, there's an enormous number, right? What is it? Shores. Sure. I don't want to get into it, you know, yeah. But right, it's 10,000 years of linear computing solved in 200 seconds. That's interesting.
Hardly wait, Vago, for your having a joint session in one of your podcasts of an alien and a caveman.
That's right. That's right. And he will have been buying Geico insurance. But how do we need to think about the age we're in and these nexus of technologies and how to, you know, expend our resources in a thoughtful manner, but then also build the policy, you know, right? As you said, we built this great cyber infrastructure and nobody considered securing it, which is why securing it has been such a challenge and what it's been such an advantage for the Chinese, right? Ultimately, it starts with a mental approach to where we are that then informs the policy and the legal, right? How do we need to think about where we are? Because where we're going is very, very exciting, but it's also potentially problematic.
So here again, my view as a general approach is to push certain principles rather than to seek highly particularistic strategies. I have very concrete views about what ought to be done in areas like quantum and other such things. I chaired a panel yesterday on quantum that's on the web from the Hopkins Applied Physics Lab. For anybody who's interested in seeing my views about quantum particularly. And we could talk one by one about areas like artificial intelligence and so forth. But the general approach, in my view, I'll give two examples of principles that I think are fundamental that I would press. One is build your talent pool. We don't really know which parts of quantum or artificial intelligence or whatever are likely to mature. We do know that having more people with more skills in those realms is like having money in the bank. You don't know what you're going to spend your bank account on, But you do know that having more money in your bank account is a good thing. So maintain that flexibility. And that involves our educational system with respect to STEM. It involves our support of R&D. It involves our integration of immigrants and our welcoming of them for the kinds of reasons we've already discussed. A second principle from my standpoint is I would push the notion of application, assimilation of these technologies much more than the normal retinue in our discussion about these things allows. It's easy to be for R&D. You can throw money at a research program and think you've accomplished something, and indeed you're doing something useful. But its attraction is that it's measurable. I'm putting $1 billion towards quantum or whatever. And its attraction is that it appeals to certain constituencies, as, for example, academia and industry, so that there's a ready-made audience and nobody's opposed to it. But the real trick is, how do you get, for example, the military services or our commercial companies, but I'll focus on the military services, to absorb the possibilities of artificial intelligence? Look, the greatest example of technological achievement informing strategy is probably Blitzkrieg. The Germans take the combustion engine and the radio, and they outflank the French, and we get the extraordinary achievements of the Germans in the opening months of World War II. But the combustion engine and the radio are available to everybody. The French have them too. They see the same things the Germans do, and I should add the airplane. But the French invent the Maginot Line. And the Germans invent Blitzkrieg. The question is really fundamentally, who absorbs the technology fastest and most imaginatively and most powerfully? And for that, there aren't particular constituencies. It isn't measurable readily by dollars and the like. The Pentagon can be spending huge amounts of money on artificial intelligence without changing its basic modes of warfare. So the question is, how do you encourage that? And here is where I think the Chinese may have the biggest advantage for two reasons. One is that they have not had the seduction of success, coming back to our earlier points. They know they're coming from behind, and they don't have such established views of their success. And they're more open and to assimilation of new things in that context. And second, the Chinese system has historically been oriented towards application rather than basic research and development. And we keep pushing research and development. They basically come along and either acquire that research and development on the open market because it's an open system that we run, or they steal it via cybersecurity and the like. But basically, their priority is on the assimilation. And our priority is not. And for me, that's a fundamental, deeply disturbing principle that has to be attended to.
I would note, though, that they're getting better at it, right? I mean, when you have an entire or several generations of Chinese scientists and engineers and thinkers educated at the feet of some of the best people in the world, whether at Caltech or MIT or Yale, I would throw that in there, and then take it home and then work at Western factories, right? It should not come as any surprise to anybody that the next generation of Chinese train or vehicle or aircraft would be a first order product as opposed to something somewhat Soviet with a coal exhaust pipe sticking out of it.
You're absolutely right. And one of the differences from the Soviet Union is precisely what you're describing, their openness, China's openness to the world, its absorption and its increasing sophistication in R&D. And I think you're right that the Chinese are becoming ever more robust in that area. But if you look at the two systems, I am not More impressed by the Chinese system's R&D than the U.S. R&D. And in many areas, including, for example, quantum and artificial intelligence, too, we've been talking about, the U.S. remains ahead and, in my view, is advantaged by our freedom of speech, our iconoclastic attitudes, the richness of our university system, et cetera. I think the U.S. should definitely be concerned about R&D and focus on it. But the dominant advantage for the Chinese, I think, in terms of their position, is not in R&D. It's in this assimilation capability. And there we are, I think, dramatically at risk. And part of the problem, I think, is that our tendency is to think, well, I'll address this by throwing more money into R&D. I'm all in favor of R&D, but don't think that that's going to get you there. In effect, you're stocking the pantry, but you haven't learned how to cook meals. And the Chinese are deeply invested in the cooking, not just the stocking.
Well, I think that a key of this, as you mentioned in terms of describing Blitzkrieg, was what's valuable is the United States, or at least the Pentagon, appears to be discovering that it has many of these tools already invented in its toolbox, and how it differently uses these set of tools, as with the big September 3 exercise where self-propelled howitzers shooting new hypersonic rounds were able to down incoming cruise missiles, is the sort of thing that we need to do more of. So to this end, I want to ask you a question of trade-offs. You and I spoke, if I recall correctly, last year. To that end, I want to ask you this question. You were on the team that assessed how much it was going to cost to actually execute the national defense strategy. And the conclusion was that it was going to actually cost much more money than we were spending. And yet there is a recognition that $750 billion is going to be the high watermark. Indeed, we are out. The national debt has grown by many trillions of dollars, in part because of economic stimulus packages, but as well because of a precipitous drop in tax revenue, and that this problem is likely going to get a lot worse before it gets any better. How do we need to think about making trade-offs? Because historically, we have not been very, very good at that. We have a tendency of doing everything we do better than we have, right? The submarines themselves get better, the aircraft carriers get better, the tanks and the guns get better. But we have not really been reinventing, I think, the way that folks believe that we likely should, right? How do we need to think about what the budgetary outlook is? And how do we start getting a lot more strategic about how we make our investments, including what we just don't do anymore? I mean, at some point, the buggy whips are no longer needed, and we have a tendency of continuously underwriting the manufacture of buggy whips, even though we've sort of transitioned to sort of autonomous cars, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a very substantial problem for anybody, and it's an arena in which it's much easier for people to preach than to practice. And since I'm not responsible any longer for practicing, I'm sensitive to the fact that it's easier to preach. But the preaching is quite clear. It's the central question, it seems to me, is not what you're for. It's what you're willing to cut. It's what you're against now. The new needs room to breathe, and it doesn't get that so long as the dominant focus is on the old programs. Everybody is for the new stuff in abstract, but when push comes to shove, what are the trade-off decisions? And that requires, I think, really starting conceptually, if you're the leadership in the Pentagon, with the new stuff and making room for it, and then allocating budgets to the established ways of doing things, the traditional ways, your buggy whips, as the residual rather than the other way around. But that conceptual framework is not identical, I think, with the way in which you persuade people to sign up for a program. If you conceptually approach the problem in the way that I've described, you can't sell it. You can't get buy-in simply by doing that. What I think you need to do is get the established authorities and thinkers to see that in order to protect what historically they valued, they need to change and absorb the new modality. That in fact, if you really care about tactical aerial combat or about warfare at sea, and you want to protect the Air Force and the Navy or the other services, you need to open the window to these kinds of activities and assimilate them into your entries. So the question is not, oh, you, the Air Force or the Navy, are outdated and we're going to start afresh, as for example, with the Space Force. It's rather, how do you get them to see that their traditional mission can only be fulfilled with some untraditional thinking? It's to recognize that the new means are required for the old ends, rather than to overthrow or try to overthrow more radically, substituting wholly new concepts without paying some deference to what people have all their lives been professionally devoted to. So this is a very complicated question to which I'm not giving adequate description, but maybe this suggests the direction of how I think you have to grapple with those things.
So would you say then that efforts to, for example, articulate plans for 386 squadrons or 500 ships might actually be not as helpful as those who would craft those strategies think they're being, right? Are those actually, are such planning actually impediments to innovation rather than enablers of change?
Yeah, you're being, I think, quite euphemistic and generous. There was no point when I was Secretary of the Navy where I endorsed a notion of we should have X number of ships. I understand why politically that provides a rallying cry, but it's not a good way, in my view, to think of strategy. One thing, for example, the Navy needs to do way more of is to recognize how cyber warfare and other kinds of tools can disable a large number of platforms, and how you need to invest much more not in the platforms, but in the digital mechanisms for protecting what we have and for moving on the offense with respect to it. This intertwines with another point that we've only slightly touched on when I talked about the professional deformation. You have to create career paths that enable people who have special technical skills to rise to the highest levels of their service. You cannot say, well, I'm going to make you an admiral only if you demonstrate command of a ship at sea and indeed of a fleet, you're an aviator equivalent. And if you happen to be extraordinarily able at cybersecurity or artificial intelligence, and you want to progress to becoming an admiral, the way to progress, the only way really to progress, is to give it up. You've got to then move to having other kinds of traditional warfare skills. It's extremely important to integrate the traditional warfare skills with the new technologies, but there's a wild imbalance in our career opportunities for the traditionalists as compared with the newcomers.
More than any other weapon the United States faces, disinformation is now worse than any hypersonic or any other, I don't want to make a nuclear analogy here, but its effects on the nation and its cohesion have been profound for less than pennies on the dollar. And ultimately, they have found home and metastasized in ways where the American people no longer have a common understanding of actual reality. And there is a large portion of the population, and far larger than most people would like to grapple with, that actually live in an alternative ecosystem that is completely not fact-based. So, And I'm not trying to make this a right or left argument, but when you see that notions like QAnon and others and conspiracy theories are fundamental enough to change the body politic in a meaningful way, you may have a problem. How does that get addressed? And how, Richard, does this not actually end up getting worse? There are folks who do make parallel arguments about the 1890s and you know, yellow journalism and everything else. But, you know, even then, you kind of had to go out of your way, you know, whereas now this stuff finds you, you easily find this information and it comes to you and you sink into these kinds of thinking, as I've seen friends of mine sort of go from one brand of very open-minded thinking to a somewhat, you know, that over time continues to sort of corkscrew away from reality. How do we need to address this, given that it is a much, much bigger threat than China is?
Well, it's an extremely important issue. I do think that historically it has been with us in vibrant forms, and we should recognize that its present manifestations are an amplification and a channeling into new technologies. But for example, the tendency for groupthink under McCarthyism in the United States and living within a limited ecosystem, or the examples you give of yellow journalism, or to pick a different kind of example from an earlier age, from the British standpoint, the proliferation of American pamphlets before the Revolutionary War was an example of a new media, relatively new, the printing press, generating new modes of thought, the coffee shop as a public place to convene, generating rumor and scandal and the like, was just a new problem for the French before the Revolution, et cetera, et cetera. So we're hardly in an unprecedented circumstance, but I do think that technologies and the like change the nature of the problem. I think there are a whole complex of things we can do. One of the affiliations that I've had historically in recent years was as a trustee of RAND for a decade, and the CEO of RAND, Michael Rich, initiated a project on truth decay, and you'll find on the RAND website a whole lot of propositions about particular kinds of steps we ought to take. Well, my view is we'll catch up with this problem. We'll deal with it, as you see Facebook and other entities trying to deal with it now. It's just that there's always a lag between the offense, the new disease or pernicious mode of attack, and the defensive development of the equivalent of the vaccine. I seem to be very rich in COVID metaphors in this hour. But I think we will get there. The particular ways we'll get there involve a lot of discussion that will take more time, and not only take more time in the sense of this limited hour we have together, but also take more time in the sense of society taking months and years to develop the, if you will, the antibodies against this. But I'm both very troubled by the problem, as you are, and I am more optimistic about our finding ways of developing immunity to it, or at least a lower degree of susceptibility to it than we have now.
Richard, thank you so much for spending so much time with us. Really, really appreciate it, and look forward to continuing the conversation. Would love to have you back on again. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Keep asking your questions and making your points. Take care.